Hello and welcome to the Mindfield Pod, another episode with me, Alexi, your host. I'm here with Anthony Payne, who's the founder of Stashby, and as we'll get into on this podcast, he's not just defined as a founder, and I think he'd be the first person to say that. But Anthony and I connected actually through LinkedIn, and we had an amazing conversation in the first sort of 30 to 45 minutes that we chatted, and we've been discussing doing a podcast, and so here he is. Welcome, Anthony.
Thanks for having me, man. Yeah, I remember that conversation. It was we wish we'd had the record button, because we got into stuff straight away.
yeah, those are the best types of conversations. But as we were talking about before, it can be quite difficult to have those types of conversations as soon as the record button goes on. But I have no doubt that today we're going to end up having a really good conversation. We're going to go deep. We've decided that Anthony actually said to me before this podcast that he'd been waiting for me to get the call up from me, because he knows that I like to not beat around the bush, and we're going to talk very openly about your life and founder life and various other interesting things that come up.
Yeah, I'd love that, and avoid paid marketing. Awesome. And boring shit like that.
yeah, we'll sell your company at the end. Nice. Or your couple of different ventures, but until then we'll get cracking. So normally I ask on other podcasts, I've asked whether you know the journey that people have to this point and to sort of define it, but I think that in the spirit of this podcast, what I'd really like to go into from our conversation that we've had is, you've mentioned, and you mentioned this online as well, that there are four particular defining, actually traumatic moments that you've been through on your journey. So I would love if you could speak a little bit about those, why they're, you know, defining, and sort of give us a bit of insight into you and what you're all about.
Yeah, definitely. A luxury and a pleasure to be able to, I guess, just talk about them freeform. So I guess when I say traumatic events, I mean sort of defining things that happened in my adult life that in some way changed the direction of who I was becoming as a man, but also my career. So I'm not really talking about all the stuff that happens when, you know, when I was a kid or as a teenager. I kind of mean four belief system changing things that happen. So I'll go through them. The first one was in my early 20s, and I went through the process of realizing that I was in the wrong job, in the wrong country, with the wrong people, trying to do something that wasn't quite right for me on any level. And that was difficult because it led me to a depression whereby I thought, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, so I need to keep doing it. And that eventually got to some sort of, you know, breaking point. The second one was a few years later when I was 26, going on 27, and a very dear friend of mine died suddenly in a car accident. And that had an altogether different impact on me, and it was all to do with, you know, meditating on my own death and thinking a lot about the finiteness of things and, I guess, reframing the decisions I was making, some passively and some actively, with this new kind of death framing. And that actually ended up getting me into startup world. I'm going through these quite quickly because I'm sure we'll go back and dive into some of them. The third one was around the age of 30. So by that point, I was already a startup founder. I identified as a startup founder. I think we were heading into our second round of funding, and it was the first time I really experienced running out of money and having promised a lot of people a lot of things, or at least that's how it felt. And I was using all sorts of interesting coping mechanisms, interesting being one word for them. And it just so coincided with getting into a relationship, a romantic relationship, for the wrong reasons. And it also coincided with a period of time where I ended up relying on drugs. So I ended up taking a lot of cocaine. And it's sort of like, it was all like an emotion soup that led to a pretty bad burnout. And then off the back of that, I learned a bunch of stuff. And then the last one was only a couple of years ago when I was 33. And that was after going through COVID and watching the company Stashbury go. It was on this growth trajectory, and then it kind of went flat, and then it went down. My self-esteem followed the growth curve. And in that period of time, you know, we all went through the COVID thing. But I also lost my father during that time. And at the end of it, I had to take 2 months off work and, I guess, work through on what basis was I going to go back to work, and what was I really working for. So there's a lot in each one of those, but every single one of them kind of like broke me down and rebuilt me into something way stronger. So as I've been reflecting more on it recently, it's been cool to kind of turn them into episodes in my head, and then break them down into, you know, lessons and I guess things to share with other people, because I think a lot of what I just said is very relatable to a lot of people. So yeah, that's the whistle stop tour.
Yeah, it's great. Couldn't help but thinking, do you ever think about what the next one might be?
You know what? Not really, but I'm pretty sure that if you are a person who kind of attacks life, as in you're quite hungry for stuff, for change, for experiences, for risk, just like, you know, you want to go get at stuff, you're going to get bumps and scrapes and bruises in unexpected ways. So I don't really think about what it's going to be, but I have close to 100% certainty that there'll be some more at some point.
And how does having that sort of mindset or outlook on life, how do you think that allows you to overcome these events that will, as you said, inevitably come up?
Well, it's interesting, because if there's a, I was just joking with you about how, this is not to kind of make myself sound intellectual or anything, but I was joking about how I've got this microphone on a copy of The Art of War, and one of my, you know, favorite sort of proverbs from The Art of War is this idea of, now I'm sounding really wanky. I'm going to go with it. Just give me 30 seconds. This idea of yield to overcome, which is, you know, you if you try and push against something, it pushes back harder at you. And if you find acceptance and you sort of let it become part of you, then you become stronger, even though you're not fighting it anymore. And actually, in every single one of these four episodes that I spoke about, the common theme is this sense of kind of letting it go. So the first one, it was, there are all these things that society supposedly tells me I should do with my professional career and my life, and I'm going to kind of let that go. There was the one about things are supposed to happen at certain points in time, and I'm going to let that go.
Mm-hmm.
Death. I'm going to let go of that. I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm not afraid on any level, but I, in a large way, letting go of the fear of death. And most recently, letting go of the idea that anyone else's definition of my achievements is in any way how I'm going to measure success, because I really did think, you know, if I don't raise it a big valuation and TechCrunch don't write about it, then I'm probably not successful. You know, it sounds stupid, but also letting go of that. So yeah, I think the way it helps me is that there will be something else that comes up, and if I had to guess, the way to deal with it will be to figure out what it is that I'm pushing up against, that's pushing back at me, and that there's some sort of letting go that has to happen.
I love that, and I can resonate so much with it. I think a lot of people call it, you know, we all call it different things. Some people call it surrender, but some people, you know, often it's letting go. For me, it's definitely letting go. And often that is the lesson in everything. And it sounds so simple, often, but you don't, what you alluded to there is you often don't realize that you're grappling so tightly with something until it's right there in front of you and you've hit potentially rock bottom. You've gone round and round in circles over and over again. And then finally you just, it hits you in the face and you're like, oh, all I needed to do was just accept, surrender. But often that's quite difficult, right? Because we're told, I guess, I've been told in life as I'm growing up, that you don't just accept what is. You go out and change it. You go out and do this. And it's kind of part of the founder journey, right, as well, which is like you always find a way past something, through it, smash through it, get over it, get under it, whatever it is, which can be a great trait. And that is something that is in every founder from what I've seen. But perhaps that's often when we finally get to something that we actually don't need to get over. It's just about letting go. I think it's a really interesting theme that you've seen kind of creep across all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And a reminder that when it next comes up.
What's fun, just to build on...
Just let it go.
Yeah, just let it go. Like the movie Frozen, which I've watched more than a single man in his mid-30s probably should confess to. It's a good film.
It's got some great tunes in it as
great
well.
Tunes I've seen in Spanish a few times. That's some good shit. Just to build on what you were saying, I think by the way, while you were talking, I choked on some water and I managed not to cough, so I'm feeling very proud of myself.
Couldn't hear it.
It was close. This whole thing of being a person who smashes through barriers and kind of doesn't accept things, I've become more aware that there are lots of ways in which there are lots of narratives which we get, I guess, from the world and from like our parents and our friends and all these kinds of things, and there are some which are only held by a few people, and there are some narratives which are like they're just really common. And so a common narrative on, you know, when to sort of let go or relax would be, you know, don't be too hard on yourself, which at its core I think is a really good sentiment. I think probably self-punishing is not the way to necessarily get places, but I think there's nuance in it. So for me, I make a really clear distinction between accountability and guilt, let's say. So I can be accountable to the fact that I said I would do something this week or today and I didn't find the time or I prioritized something else. I think we're in a slightly lower state of awareness. You don't realize that actually what you're doing is you're creating guilt as opposed to accountability. And so for example, I like to track stuff. I track a lot of stuff. You know, I'm always tracking something, like I'm trying to wake up at a certain time or touch my toes, or I'm literally tracking how close to my toes I am, all the way across to like
Are you genuinely doing that? Is that the latest track?
Well, I do about 20 at once. It's like a big spreadsheet with like, it's a row of tick boxes, and then I look at the data afterwards, and I do it for like 100 days just to set. I like to set a direction and then track against it. Mm. But the point is, if I miss, I was having this conversation with someone yesterday. If I miss and I don't do my 3K run, which is a thing I'm trying to do every day, or I don't my LinkedIn post, which is something I try and do every day. Other people see that and go, you're being too hard on yourself and you are creating guilt. So you should let it go, like the Frozen film. I look at that spreadsheet and I go, there's no guilt going on here. This is my mechanism for productive accountability so that I can get closer. Actually, it's not even get closer to the goal. It's so that I can take steps in the direction of that I want to go in. And this idea of you should just let go of stuff is I think for me is highly subjective. And I think if you're a founder and you can kind of be, I think many of us are quite belligerent types. I feel that way. It can make other people a bit uncomfortable, you know? Like, my mum says stuff like, why are you so intense? Like, I don't know, man. You raised me. But yeah, sorry, that was a bit of a rabbit hole, but you brought up lots of thoughts there with what you said.
No, I love that. No, I love the tangent that you went on there. I think there's a lot can be taken from that. I think what I get from what you've said is that someone could be doing the exact same thing as you. They could be tracking like 50 variables. It's the same as when someone asks me about my Whoop, just like the exercise band and recovery band that I use. They're like, oh, but doesn't that make you just kind of overthink or feel guilty every time you see that you've had a bad day or you haven't done exercise or when you track over months? And ultimately it comes down to just the, and I know it sounds like I'm throwing it around, but the basis of it is the mindset I have around that, which is kind of similar or might be different to yours. But what I heard from what you're saying is that I get to see all of these things. I get to hold myself accountable. I get to understand what I've improved on, what I haven't, and then I get to decide on what I'm going to do with it. Mm-hmm. Right? So it doesn't mean that you have to apply guilt to mm-hmm. it, but you can use that information and you can change what you're doing about it. A lot of the things, I don't know if you find this with you, a lot of the things I question about, do I care? Do I care that I've tracked that and that is going a different way? And if I ultimately don't, then I do let that go. And I'm like, that's absolutely fine. I was kind of more just tracking it just to see if I cared about it. But then if there's something where I'm like, that really bugs me, well, maybe that's something to dig into. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just going into deeper as to why that thing is something that you're chasing after. Why does that upset you the most? Because I think what's so cool about what you've said is that there's such why people get stuck in guilt is because it's actually so close to what they think accountability is. Mm-hmm. And I've definitely been there. But my one kind of learning from it is that you can't really do anything if you're stuck in guilt. You can't do anything with the information you've got. But if you are accountable and you're like, okay, well, yeah, okay, I could be doing that better. That's something that I've seen, it's dropped off a curve, so what's going on here? But instead of just overthinking as to why and the what's wrong with me, I think it's kind of the application of probably where you've got this from, which is the, what's that book, Habits?
Atomic Habits.
Atomic Habits, right? Which is that, you know, it's not about willpower. It's not about like me naturally just being inept at certain things. It's just, what am I applying importance to? And how do I now set myself up to achieve the things that I really want to achieve? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I don't know whether it was that the author of Atomic Habits or someone else who said this, but an idea that has definitely stuck to my brain and comes up quite a lot, is this idea that motivation is like a muscle, in the sense that, like a muscle, you can build it up and make it stronger if you use it in the right amount. If you underuse it, it gets weaker. And if you overuse it, you can exhaust it, and then you can basically break it. And so, call it motivation, call it discipline, self-discipline. If you can find a pace that works for you, then you can positively compound your ability to keep doing stuff. So for example, let's take one of those things, which was my posting that I was doing. So I used to be really like not into posting on social. In fact, we spoke about this when we first spoke. You know, it's quite exposing. It feels attention grabby. And then I had a really inspiring conversation with Yasin Nomeri, who used to work with us at the time as our head of growth. He's now started his own thing. And he was saying, look, man, you're a startup founder. I find you inspiring, which I thought was very generous of him to say. But you're not doing anything to put that out yet there. In fact, there's an opportunity for growth there that you're not leaning into, which is find your voice on a bigger stage, and maybe it'll help your companies grow. Maybe you'll create new connections. You know, maybe you'll end up on Alexi's podcast. Didn't know that at the time, right? So this is a direct result of that. So into a tracker it went. The goal was do it every day, no matter what. Some days I posted at 1 minute to midnight. But because the goal was very simple, it was just get something out in a 24-hour period. The motivation muscle got stronger because I wasn't trying to post five times in a day, and I wasn't giving myself a free pass when I missed. So if I missed one day, I was like, okay, I missed, but I damn well make sure I get it the next day. So never miss for 2 or 3 days in a row. And so I like to think of motivation as this muscle that you can either wither, get stronger, or get so fatigued that it won't work for ages. And you know, I think that applies from everything from like weight loss through to, gosh, I find it quite hard to talk about my feelings, and now there's a block between me and my husband. I'm going to try and keep myself accountable to at least every day share a small thing. So it's not just company building or venture building. You know, it's I think it's going to be applied to anything.
For sure. Yeah, I so see that. I think it's the complications that we add to things and how we build them up and what they need to be. It was exactly the same with me with posting. As soon as I took away the what I need to post and the quality and the this, it was like, no, this is actually the goal is for me to put stuff out, get some feedback from it, learn how to be disciplined in putting out a certain amount, and just be able to look past the fear, because the fear ultimately was the thing that was coming up, which was but the fear then turns into other things like, oh, this just isn't good enough. This isn't, but actually what it is I think I'm going to be judged for it. And you know, then it turns into, do I want to put stuff out? Of course I don't want to put stuff out, but actually in that moment I don't. But what I do want to do is over time I do want to, because as you said, things like this come up, which you wouldn't have known. You'll have interactions. I'll end up, yes, whether it's a business acquisition or, you know, I gain a client from it, fine. But let's just focus on what it's going to do for me and me only. And ultimately, I think giving a time limit for it is also useful, right? Like just saying, right, 3 months, I'm going to see if there's any evidence that, and if I don't feel like it, then fine. Then at least I can say I've done that and I can move on.
Yeah, I think time limit, but, time boxing
yeah,
is
I think it's
super powerful.
Yeah, because I think, if you think about all the things you could try and get good at and you could try and build habits on, if you're not that interested in it after 2-3 months, if you then want to add something else and then add something else, and then a new thing comes out like ice baths, or a new thing comes out like, you know, yoga once a day, I think people get caught into this trap that you need to continue to do all of those things, and even the things that you didn't actually enjoy before. And you're actually just reducing capacity for the things that will help you, that do stick, that do work. But I think it's a really interesting one, insight that you've given there on just why you track, and that difference between kind of guilt and accountability is so powerful when you get it. And also what you just said about motivation and building the muscle of motivation rather than like applying it to the actual thing you're doing. You're just building discipline or self-discipline and putting aside what it is that you're trying to do with it. So I think that's really powerful. So to jump to something that I find such an interesting conversation on, death, and you mentioned you've been through an experience of having someone really close to you dying. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that and the lessons that you've learned, but particularly then on kind of how you've led to not allowing death to be something that you fear, because it can kind of, often what I've seen, it can kind of go one of two ways. So I would love to hear about that.
Yeah, definitely. And it sounds like a weird thing to say, but it's one of my favorite topics to get into properly, because it's so still today, you know, 2023, in I think most Western cultures, we're not very in touch with death, I would say. I grew up in Brazil, which is a culture where you talk about the dead a lot. And even it goes down to things like, in, you know, if you have a funeral, it's very long and hundreds of people come, people who don't even know the person, and it's an open casket and you sing songs. And I think there's something cultural that I don't know enough about, actually, and I'd be super interested to dig more into it. But about how we think about death here in, you know, places like here in the UK or let's say in the US. So for me, you know, obviously I'd had, you know, grandparents pass away and, you know, people who are a little bit removed from me. But when I was in my mid-20s, it was the second episode I was referring to there. I was working for a consultancy. I had already had sort of a stint where I left the corporate world for about 9 months to try and build this startup. I was kind of joining a pre-existing thing. It's almost, I don't know whether it's sort of endearing or terrifying, how little I knew and all the ways in which it was obviously doomed to fail, and then the ways in which it may not have failed, I just poured gasoline on it without realizing. So obviously that blew up and I went back into corporate, but it was essential. It was an essential part of the process to get any good and to realize that actually I did want to be an entrepreneur. But anyway, there I am. I'm back in corporate land. I have a client who are trying to reduce the cost of their data centers. They've got like 30 data centers spread around Europe. They've bought loads of companies and now they're going, oh, we spend £500 million a year on this, and we need to figure out how to fire hundreds of people, but it's very complicated. So my job was model in spreadsheets how many people we could fire to reduce the infrastructure bill for this company. And I'm sort of implying it in the way I explained it there, but like I was not feeling sort of driven by this mission, you know. I was, in fact, I kind of
hard to get behind.
Yeah, it just wasn't very inspiring. And I was getting up at 4 a.m. on a Monday to fly to Germany, and then coming back late on a Friday. My life was just flights and spreadsheets, and I was getting fat and, you know, eating. I remember I used to eat schnitzel at midnight in the hotel room because I was working, and I, you know, I couldn't be bothered to get up and go get some food because I had work to do. And anyway, I was in a bit of a hole. And then I got the news that someone very special to me, who I'd met years earlier, her and her fiance had been hit by a car. You know, they were just pedestrians. They weren't doing anything wrong. It was actually a stolen vehicle, and the people who stolen it were driving too fast, and they lost control, and they hit the two of them, and they both died on the scene. And it was I'm not even going to say like getting punched in the gut. It was like the emotional equivalent of getting kicked in the nuts. Like it was, I felt the pain through my whole body. And I don't think I've ever experienced something like that where I was kind of speechless and had my breath taken away by it. It was just so unexpected, so many feelings that I didn't know what to do with. And this happened while I'm in a boardroom with these clients, running through a spreadsheet about how many people we can fire from this department in some country. And I saw it pop up on Facebook. I had about 3 seconds of I'm processing, and then I was straight back into delivering this presentation. I didn't get up from my seat. I didn't cry. I didn't. It was imperceptible to the outside world, and so my internal world had just ruptured, and I just continued because I was like, oh, I'm not going to disrupt this very important thing where I'm explaining, you know, severance packages in Italy to a German infrastructure director from a company that I don't give a fuck about. And over the coming days and weeks, I realized just how why that had been so huge for me. And first of all, and secondly, why I felt compelled to just completely hide it. The reason why it was so huge for me is because my friend, even though she was young, had died, in my estimation, as a fulfilled, happy person. Like, she hadn't achieved everything that she wanted to achieve in her life, but she was living every day in the way that she wanted. It wasn't some kind of like, when I'm much older, I'll start doing things I enjoy. She wasn't in a job she didn't like. She wasn't dating someone she didn't want to be dating. She had ups and downs, like all of us, but she was just doing what she wanted. And it was like having a mirror held up to me that said, dude, you don't like anything about your life. Like, none of it. So if that had been you and you were floating up to somewhere, if there is a place to float up to or down to or whatever, your reaction wouldn't have been, ah, yeah, I had a good go of that. Fair enough. Thanks, life. It would have been, shit. I never did anything that I wanted to do. Like, I sat there in the goddamn boardroom talking about the numbers on the spreadsheet. I kept myself in a relationship that deep down I knew I didn't want to be in. And as it pertains to like career, I always wanted to go build my own company. I was just scared, which is natural, by the way. It's normal. But basically, it was if you died tomorrow, you'd be really annoyed. So start living differently. And so that was like having a little sit down on a park bench with death, and death was like, hey, man, let me tell you, I'm going to have to come back at some point. It might be tomorrow. It might be like in 50 years. But word of advice, like, maybe just stop doing stuff you don't want to do and start doing stuff you do want to do. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, I could go on about it, but that's the crux of that thing, and it led to the changes that made me let go of those fears, or confront those fears, and start a company. And ultimately, actually, I came up with the idea for Stashby kind of as a direct result of that, because I moved out and then I had to use storage. So, but yeah.
There you go. I love little, whatever they call, little things like that, because you just made a move that set off a sort of ripple effect in your life, and one of them was the idea for your company just by taking that leap. And I think what you implied is that you left your girlfriend or your ex-girlfriend,
yeah,
and then that led to finding. And I think that's so, I love hearing those things, because I have so many people come to me and just be like, I don't know what to do, I don't know what the next thing is going to be, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that I'm not happy. And it's like, you just have to start doing and honoring who you are. And that one thought of like, okay, I don't like that, stop doing it. Because you'll learn something from stopping doing that. You'll pick up something else because you're bored. You know, or whatever it is, it's so small. But you can't if you continue the way that you do. And that's why ultimately I always come back to it. There has to be some sort of action that goes with it, because then you're going to get a learning from it. You're going to get a different perspective from it. So I mean, I haven't experienced having someone really close to me go, but I've definitely been so close to my own feeling that I didn't want to be alive, that kind of scares me enough to be like, right, fucking hell, you've got to change something here. Is that really, a bit like you saying it, you know, the devil kind of knocks it. Is this really what you're going to do with all the kind of privilege that you have, all of the great things that on paper are going on in your life? Like, is this it? And it's like, no. So the thing that comes up for me, because I've had the experience of when I'm doing, now that I'm doing a lot of things, I can't say that I'm always honoring what I feel like I'd love to do every day. And by the way, that doesn't mean, you know, run off into the sunset, which some people think it might mean. Mm. I feel like with my coaching and with what I'm doing right now, and I'm honoring often choosing personal things and pleasure, or even things to do with my work, I just choose to do them and I just say, fuck it. I'm still disciplined to a certain degree, but I let a lot of things go. I feel like I'm honoring what, I wouldn't be disappointed if something happened to me. And I genuinely believe that. I never, ever thought I would get to that belief at some point. But do you think that that sort of comes from, I don't know, where do you think that comes from? What is your now perspective on kind of death and moving forward? Is it, do you now have this outlook of you're more relaxed about death coming just because of that? Or are there other things that are at play there? What else have you kind of worked out in this journey?
Yeah, I think that whole story I just told was kind of the, like a really aggressive direction change, like that happened very fast. And then since then, because it's coming up to 10 years now, since then there's been so many other kind of extra lessons and things that have got layered on. So I think whilst it's still rooted in the core of, you know, just do things you want to do, I think my perspective has changed. You know, since then I lost my father, and I had my own sort of, you know, episodes of depression and whatnot. So I think today, these days, I wouldn't say I'm relaxed about it. I actually think it's similar to we were saying guilt versus accountability. It's not that I'm scared of death. It's that I find it a healthy thing to meditate on frequently. To to give me some drive. And that doesn't mean that I don't ever, you know, relax, because I think relaxing is also part of life. But, you know, if I'm, let's say, for example, if my alarm goes off early and I don't really feel, you know, if my first thought is, oh, can't be bothered, like it's cold, the thought that will always these days come in and sort of defeat it or be much louder than it is this, wow, I get another day. Like every day when you go to sleep, everything stops existing as far as you're concerned. Well, this is how I see it. Like if you're going to be, you know, brain in a vat about it, it's like, how do I know that anything is going to be there ever again? And so when you regain consciousness each time, I'm like, wow, that's incredible that I get another one. Because there's only a few thousand of them probably, and then there'll be no more. So like, I don't, it's not a lack of fear. It's more a healthy accountability and a gratitude, I think, for life. Yeah. And also, you know, that whole thing you were saying about, you know, maybe I put something out on social media and someone's going to judge me, or someone's going to be offended, or someone's not going to like something, or I'm going to put my foot in it with an investor. I think the further I go down this route of after I'm gone, it's not going to matter, the less any of that even touches the sides. You know, there are ways in which people get furious at you and you kind of go, yeah, I'm actually not sure on a cosmic scale whether that matters. And so
they'll be crying at my funeral. That's what I'm thinking. Like, you know, they're not going to be pissed off about this, me being late, or whatever else I've done to them that is so minuscule compared. They'll be thinking, why did I get annoyed at him for being late?
Yeah.
I just told him how much I loved him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, something else you said just before, I just remembered, you gave me two other thoughts. One of them was this thing of like, you know, you meet someone at a party and it's like, what do you do? And they say, which by the way, it's an annoying question. I don't know why. I don't quite like the phrasing. It's like,
we all what, know.
You know, yeah. I'm trying to label you, whatever. What do you do? And someone says to me, I'm a plumber, let's say. Something that there's a choice there to either go into, okay, nice, my uncle's a plumber, cool, relatability on a very superficial level, or what do you like about it? What do you dislike about it? And all of a sudden you're kind of, you're going down this route of, we're sort of talking about death and the meaninglessness of everything, and actually like, just tell me like what's really going on inside you. Or, yeah, my uncle's a plumber, that's cool, bye. So that was one thought I had. And the other one...
No, I love that.
It's fun to try, because sometimes people are like, what kind of a question is that, you freak?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, but it's actually the only thing that keeps me interested in these types of conversations, right? And when I catch myself just doing the usual, like, oh, what do you do? Or I generally don't get caught in that, but I'm having one of those kind of surface level conversations, which a lot of people, you know, like, and I can understand how it can be exhausting to always go into the why of everything. But it's more fun for me, and I've found that is what keeps me interested, and I can talk to anyone if I ask them questions, like you're saying, and I dig into something that has meaning. But ultimately, I like the way you said, ultimately, I'm basically going to ask you if what you're doing is worth living for, or whatever sort of other version of that there is. Yeah. But it's actually a good lesson that I've learned for is that, you can get bored. I used to get bored very easily with particular people, that, you know, the people that I maybe don't relate to as well, or they don't have the same energy as me, or whatnot. However, I can now pretty much have a very interesting conversation with anyone, because I'm asking actually what I really care about. And it's just that simple switch of, well, I don't mind if they, you know, if I end up kind of like getting into a conversation that upsets them, maybe like I hit on a point that's quite touchy or whatnot, and then I just deviate from it if need be. But ultimately, people do want that. They want people to be interested in them. But I think it's just asking questions, like you said, rather than just relating it to a part of your own life, which it's just like that doesn't take it kind of anywhere.
Yeah, easier to do because it's less challenging. And like you say, not everyone wants to go down to the depths of everything. And actually, catch me on the wrong day. Not the wrong day, just on a specific day, that all I really want to talk about is that I'm craving some, I don't know, nice and spicy knickknacks, and that I was playing PS4 last night, and I don't want to talk about cosmic coincidence, and I don't want to talk about space-time, and I don't want to talk about, you know, death or but 9 times out of 10 I do, so.
yeah exactly. But 100% we're not all like that, and I think it's actually just being honest in your reply when someone does. And you know, for example, if my girlfriend brings up something in the evenings that is just going to take sort of a bit too the wrong part of my headspace, I'll just, now I'm much better at being like, let's talk about it in the morning. Like, that would be great, because that's where a lot of kind of frustration comes, and you know, not feel, it's just being honest about how you feel. But I think, it, as we're saying, if you ask people the question, you give them the permission. They have the permission to say whether they want to answer that or not. But yeah, it makes for much more interesting. For me, it makes for much more interesting conversation. You learn so much more about someone than just what do they do in a day to day, because we know what plumbing entails, but we don't know why they might love plumbing, which is interesting, or why they might hate it, but why they still do it, which is still really interesting. But anyway, I've really enjoyed the deaf conversation, and it's something that as soon as I heard you talk about it, I was like, we're gonna touch on that, because not many people will go, not head to head, it sounds like we're having a death conversation game, but will sort of speak to me about, yeah, a death off. But I think I fear death less than you. the one on the plane is always a funny one to end on. Like I get the turbulence and everyone's like, and I'm like, see you in hell sort of thing. And I'm just like, I'm like ready to, I don't know. There's something weird. I think I'm a bit too relaxed about it, which is what this conversation has brought up, where I need a bit of like, okay, get real, Alexi. You know, you do actually want to be here. And of course I do. But I think it's that not afraid. Anyway, I'd love to go on to maybe another taboo subject. You mentioned whilst you're going through a bit of a crisis with your business, I think money in terms of getting to a point where you're really desperate, was that a similar time to when you picked up a coke addiction, or am I just making that?
Yes, that was around about the same time.
Okay.
And plus some other stuff going on.
I think the money thing comes up in so many conversations that I have with founders. It is one of the, and people that I know close to me, you know, even if you come from a good amount of wealth or you don't, it still affects us hugely. And it is one of the biggest leaders to depression if you are under constraints. And I even had someone actually approach me today who's a founder who just out of the blue on Instagram and pretty much just let that out in the first conversation we had. And so I know it's really prevalent. I know a lot of people go through it, but what was your experience with money and what did it get you into and what did you learn from it?
Yeah. So I think to answer that question is something I've thought a lot about and gone quite deep on. I think to answer that question, I'd like to go back to how did the meaning I assign to money get formed? Because I think for all of us, we develop meaning and then we attach them to things. And so, for example, I might have a friend who attaches certain meaning to wearing really nice clothes and looking good. And I might attach a different meaning to wearing really nice clothes and looking good. And they could be totally different. So just apply that to money. And how I think it got formed for me was I had a British father and an English mother. Still have an English mother. My father's passed away now. And my retrospective read on the money dynamic was my father grew up with very little resource and quite a humble kind of upbringing in Brazil. And from a young age, he was very driven to make lots of money, basically. That was like a driving force. And he had a lot of identity wrapped up in being a provider, you know, like the traditional patriarch sort of center of the family, creating income. My mother had grown up on a farm that had been in our family for years and years and years. And they were fine. There was, you know, it wasn't exceptionally wealthy. They were never poor. But for them, it was very much you get up, you count the sheep, you tend to the land. And it was very sort of slow and steady. So you kind of had these two, one person who was trying to reach escape velocity and kind of do this rocket ship thing where they, you know, escape the atmosphere and go from being poor to rich. And this other person who came from this very slow and steady, I have as much as my dad has, and his dad had the same amount as his grandparents had. So when those two different views of money combined, and then you started to layer on things like mixing cultures and all the rest of it, I grew up in this environment where our money situation was very boom and bust, because my dad sometimes had it and he felt good about himself. And then when he didn't, he felt bad about himself. And as a child, you pick that up. And my mom was doing the slow and steady thing to basically hold it all together. And so I had these like two forces in my head. One of them was money is very hard to get and hold on to, which is the one I got from my dad. And the other one is, be very careful, be fearful, because if you don't, just, you know, slow and steady, you'll lose it. So these two framings, right? Money's hard to get.
you're stuck there. That's all I could say. Yeah. Those are two very different ones. And I can see how that would be a horrible place to be stuck in between.
Right, exactly. And you know, when you're a kid, you don't really understand this stuff, but like fast forward.
Of course.
And some of these, you know, crunch points like the one you've just mentioned, I'm going, the belief system that seeped in is getting money is really, really hard. I'm probably not ever going to be able to figure that out. But if I don't, I will continue to be unsafe like I was in my childhood. And don't take risks. So clearly I was sort of dragging myself through a hedge backwards, saying, well, you should probably become an entrepreneur then, because that'll, you know, like a moth to flame, like go do the thing that is the hardest with that belief system. And yep. The first time that really kicked my ass was when, you know, we'd valued the company at a few million and we had lots of investors and we raised some money. It wasn't like, it doesn't really matter how many zeros are on it, right? To me, it felt like a gajillion dollars. And I had a team and, you know, the team had families. And my framing wasn't, if this all fucks up, everyone will just go get another job and it'll be fine. And I'll just look everyone in the eye and say, look, it didn't work. My framing was, if this doesn't work, it's the end of all things, you know, like... then it definitely means that I'll never make any money, and it will definitely mean that I'll never be safe, and it will mean I didn't listen to my mom and I was totally irresponsible. I kind of had to go back to childhood a bit there to come back to like why I found it so stressful.
That really, really helps.
Yeah. I think it gets, and this is something that every early stage founder will contend with if they raise money, is it gets compounded by this thing that whereby you sell parts of your company based on future potential in order to fund today. So you borrow from the future to fund today. And if you're a first, second, or third time founder, first especially, and if stuff doesn't go according to plan, which, hint, never does, then that little formula is not gonna just do what you want it to do. You'll run out of money and things will go wrong. And so that's where I was at that time. And it just so happened that I also got into a relationship where I think I was maybe trying to compensate for my self-image as a farcical entrepreneur who actually doesn't know how to make money and is making bad decisions and taking lots of risks. And I ended up getting a relationship that was wasn't a good fit, wasn't super compatible, I think, both ways. But I was probably looking for that other person to love me in a way that I wasn't loving myself. And it just so happened that in that world, I was exposed to drugs. And that for me was like, I was really into coffee, right? And like I was saying earlier, I could be quite extreme about things. So I was like, oh, so there's this powder that gives me energy that means that I can just do more and do more and do more and do more and maybe even fix this money problem. And I can still socialize and be like super charming and fun. I see no downsides. I'm going to bulk buy this shit.
Right.
So that's how the running out of money, oh God, everything's going to end, mixed with getting into drugs stuff. And yeah, I mean, we got through it and I got through it by sort of sheer perseverance. And eventually we raised some money. And off the back end, the other side of that, I was like, that was really intense, but a lot of it's self-created. So maybe I'll be a bit more healthy and maybe I won't be in that relationship anymore. And maybe I'll reevaluate my relationship to money. And, you know, I did lots of work and therapy and whatever and came through it. But yeah, that's the story of that period of time.
Yeah. A lot of lessons from that, I'll take with me. I appreciate you going through it. To sort of finish and round things off, because there's been some awesome topics that we've spoken about. What is it that ultimately, through these challenges, what do you use? You know, you've mentioned therapy there, but what are your sort of go-tos in terms of like you need? Like that is how you're going to get through it. When you know you're going through a tough time, what do you not fall back on, but what do you step into?
The first thing that comes to mind is the, I'm just going to call them like the boring essential habits. We've all heard it spoken about so many times, but if you get sleep, food, and exercise right, it just everything else is like an order of magnitude easier. And I used to be quite arrogant about that and think, I'm a young guy, I'm energetic, that's like a wuss's game. I don't need sleep, you know? And actually when I started to treat exercise, sleep and nutrition with the respect it deserves, like everything else became a lot easier. So that's one thing. The second thing is probably being really deliberate about asking myself what I think, which is hard because if you're going to get really philosophical about it, how do we form any opinions? Is it a mixture of nature, nurture, influence, or any of my thoughts, my own thoughts? Like that rabbit hole is a tricky one, but there's usually a voice inside us where we're like, this is me, this is what I think. And something I go back to again and again and again and again is if I'm reacting to something either positively or negatively, I ask, why do I feel that? So let's take an example. If to loop back to something earlier in the conversation, if someone's looking at my or listening to this saying, oh God, that guy's tracking everything, what a lunatic, and they were to say to me, that's unhealthy, there is a voice inside me that says, do I agree with you or not? Like somewhere buried inside. For me, actually, now, because I've had practice, I know what it is. It's like I respectfully disagree. You get something different than I do, so that's why I do that thing. That voice is... I almost treat it as a separate person. He is kind, he's compassionate, and he is unforgiving to the rest of the world about Anthony being Anthony. He doesn't give two fucks, basically. Whenever it all gets a bit like someone saying this and someone saying this, I talk to this guy that's inside my head and say, hey, what do we actually think? And so that's who I fall back on. I think I don't actually know if that even makes sense. That was a big old ramble, but there you go.
No, it definitely makes sense. I think anyone that says that they don't have a little guy or girl inside their head at some point is probably lying. I think some of us have it more than others, for sure. But I totally resonate with that. And I really resonate with... I mean, you're right that it has to be unforgiving to other people. It has to have you... that guy has to have you, your best interests. And it sounds simple, but what you're talking about does take a lot of practice over time. You can only... distinguish. A lot of people ask me, like, how do you distinguish between, you know, the voice that you should trust and the one that you shouldn't? Well, it takes practice. It takes like taking the other voice and hearing it and going after something and going, that didn't work how he said it was going to work. And you're like, right, I know that one. The one thing I use is that one is often quieter and speaks to you and whispers, and that's the one that's not like the sort of ego that's shouting, go on, have it, like that's what you should do, beep at that person, you know, run after that, whatever it is. The other one's just going, yeah, no, actually you don't need to do that, like you're good. You can say no to this thing. And I'm going, oh yeah, cool. Like, rather than say no, tell them you say no. Like, for me, that is so... I totally get it. Maybe we both sound bonkers at this point, but I love talking about what's going on inside people's heads. It was one of the first things that I asked when I was really young, that people are like, are you okay? Is there something wrong with you? Because I asked in the playground when I was about, I don't know, between 7 and 13, and I was just like, is it... like, do you have a voice inside your head? You know, I was going around asking people, like, is it just me? And I wouldn't get really much of a reply, so I just thought it was me. And then that was all kind of realized after that it was different. But anyway, go back to your bits. Is there anything else that you really go to that you feel like you want to share on this podcast?
Maybe.
And maybe let's make it a bit more specific.
Go ahead.
If we make it a bit more specific to also being the type of founder that you've been talking about, it comes with a lot of challenges. I mean, it's been... I love not talking about work until sort of this moment right at the end, but it is really important. Obviously, a lot of this is applied to being a founder, you as one yourself. But these bigger topics actually really help as a founder, I think, is what you'd also agree with. But what particularly to the founder journey would you say has really helped you in terms of sort of be a better person, be a better business person? Anything else on that?
I think if I had to pick out one theme, because sometimes these lessons, they present themselves to you, the same lesson again and again. It's like the same song, and you only hear the song on the 50th time. And we actually spoke about this just before the recording started. And it's now discussed so much that it's kind of like the in vogue cliche thing, which is vulnerability. But I'm going to say it anyway, because... and this links back to that whole idea of like yields to overcome and just let it go, is... a lot of the things I've managed to move through has been by giving myself permission to be honest about how it's actually making me feel. So a couple of examples off the top of my head. I'm in this corporate career and job, and I have to be doing these things, and you know, if I quit, what the hell are they going to think of me? What am I going to think of myself? And actually saying, guys, thank you so much for the opportunity for being here, but I currently don't feel fulfilled, and I really feel a call to go do something else, to do my own thing. Everything evaporated. I had empathy, support. My job was kept for me for a year. I didn't create a narrative. Years later, when I had to take 2 months off work because I had a huge burnout and I didn't even know if I was ever going to go back to work. When I came back, I did an all hands with the team and said, guys, this is what happened. And I walked them through the whole thing. Like, from the moment where my symptom, by the way, I lost my hearing mid a phone call, like a video call, my hearing went, and I was like, oh, that's probably not good. Turns out it was like a pretty big burnout, and that, you know, eventually I had to have medication and whatever. But coming back and sitting everyone down and saying, guys, this is what happened. This is some of the thinking I've been doing. This is where I've been sort of what I've been struggling with, and this is what I'm now doing to work on it, but I'm going to need some help and support from you guys. But I want to be here. All the questions that were swirling around of like, is Stashby going to continue? Is Anthony okay? Has he lost his mind? Does he not like us anymore? Has he found another more attractive, hotter startup to go and, you know, kind of have an affair with? It all disappears because I was vulnerable. And I know I've just picked two data points. But more and more I'm falling back on it, and it, you know, opens doors. Like, I never dreamt that I could have a conversation like this without even really thinking that much or being that self-aware of the fact that other people are going to listen to it and that maybe someone will get some value from it. And so I think it's such a powerful tool. I don't really care that it's a bit of a cliche right now. I'm going to keep doing it anyway, and I'll probably keep doing it after it goes out of fashion, so to speak.
Yeah. I think what you touched upon is probably easier to understand for people than just throwing the word vulnerability around. I think what you touched upon, what I got from it, was that actually if you're in a bit of a difficult spot, you're not sure what to do. And I've had this with a lot of clients as well, is it comes down to what can you do? Just be honest. You can only be honest with those around you. And that doesn't mean putting it out on social media straight away when you don't really understand what's going on, which is the conversation we were having before this. Mm. That's not vulnerability. Vulnerability is to me and to you, I think, is getting honest with the people around you. And actually that honesty, as you said, it opens so many doors. Mm. It's so scary. But actually, as you said, the reaction's like, oh, like we thought you were, you know, going to leave us, or we thought this was going on, or something way worse, because the human mind is very creative at coming up with awful stories. So I really think that is a great lesson that you've brought up there in terms of honesty. And if you're not sure what to do, just be honest with the people that are close to you, that are around you. Let them in, because that will be the way that you can work out what to do next. Other things will come up. And I love that. I think it's a great place to sort of finish.
Brilliant. Well, I enjoyed that a lot. I had the sense that we went in lots of different directions. I hope that it was in some way, there was some kind of narrative thread in there. I sometimes feel like I just ramble.
And by the way, this is going into the recording until we finally finish. But I think even what you've just said there is something that I love to do more and more on this podcast, to honor the conversations that I actually want to have. And it's a moment for me to be honest, which is that I can't, as I said to you, continue to pretend that I just want to be a high performance podcast, because I've never really wanted that. And I think most of the feedback is that it's not that. And what does that even mean? I think in order to be a high performer, you need to understand these things that we're talking about and the challenges. I think it will ultimately lead to that. But yeah, there was no path today, and I loved it. And I think we talked about some really interesting topics that at least we find interesting. I'm sure others will too. So I really, really appreciate it. And the last thing I will ask is, what is next for you? I know that you have started something to help startup new founders get into startups, which completely makes sense from what I've heard from you and actually how late you've started. And I do that in quoted commas, inverted commas, because you're not that late a starter, but you are later than most people now in this world.
Yeah, so that project is called Founder Jumpstart. And the website's founderjumpstart.com. And really it was a sort of a compulsion rather than anything too strategic, which was to take a lot of the stuff that we spoke about today and break it down into more bite-sized chunks and give them to people who would find value from those sort of the painful lessons, who maybe are at the beginning of their journey, or maybe they're later in the journey, doesn't really matter. But I'm kind of focused on the people who are maybe sat in there at their desk at a FTSE 100 company going, "Oh, I really want to start my own thing, but." And after the word "but" come so many different sort of self-defeating ideas, limiting beliefs, a whole bunch of like ideas soup that lacks framework, it lacks context, and it lacks tooling, actionable tooling. And so when I started having conversations like this one, having gone through all the, you know, some of the stuff we touched on today, I thought, wouldn't it be cool to give some of that to other people? So that's what Founder Jumpstart is. It is also, by the way, because I like to try and be funny, and because it's what comes naturally to me, is to not make everything like super serious. It's all communicated in bright colors and doodles and piss take. So, hey, so far so good. So people should check that out if they want to. And then I'm still running StashB, and we're getting closer and closer to profitability. And it's actually a really fun time to be the CEO of StashB, so that continues.
Awesome. I definitely know a lot of people who are in that position of sitting in a FTSE 100 or any sort of corporate job with the idea tingling in their mind, and has been for hours. I actually had a conversation with a friend this morning, a friend of a friend, who has been thinking about an idea for 2 years and is working in sales. And my first piece of advice is just take that first step, make it real if you really want to, and then see what happens from there. So I can see so much value in what you're doing, and obviously the journey you've been through. So again, thank you, Anthony, and I look forward to the next conversation, which will definitely start with the story about you going deaf for a certain amount of time, which I can't believe we even got onto that. But it's great to have more things to come back to. So again, thank you.
Awesome, man. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.